Today I'm chatting about Greek philosophy and the value of character with Massimo Piliucci. Massimo is a fascinating scholar. He has a PhD in evolutionary biology, but in his midlife crisis, he turned to philosophy. After obtaining his second doctorate, he became a professor of philosophy, and currently he's the K.D. Irani Professor of Philosophy at City College of New York. He has published over 150 technical papers in biology and philosophy and authored 16 books, including How to Be a Stoic, Using Ancient Philosophy to Live a Modern Life, as well as Nonsense on Stilts, How to Tell Science from Bunk. Here I speak with him about the ancient Greeks and their teachings on character, virtue, politics, and so many other ideas that can be found in his recent book, The Quest for Character, What the Story of Socrates and Alcibiades Teaches Us About Our Search for Good Leaders. You can check out Massimo's work on his website, massimopiliucci.org, or the Substack, Figs in Winter. And now I welcome Massimo Piliucci. Massimo, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into The Quest for Character, which is your most recent book, and actually, let me say, you teach at City College, which is a CUNY school. I'm a huge CUNY fan. I did my master's at Brooklyn College, my master's in history. My grandfather a long time ago went to City College, and I've been there. It's a beautiful campus. So
nice. Yeah, that's what I teach.
Yeah, I'm glad that you're there. It's a wonderful institution. Your newest book, The Quest for Character, which is fantastic. And one of the things, Massimo, that I love about your philosophical writing is it has such a friendly, accessible tone to it for an average reader to be able to follow your arguments. And I really, really appreciate that. And the book title involves Socrates, but it's much wider than that, I have to say. It's really a tour of ancient Greek philosophy, and the Socrates part maybe throws you off a little bit because it's definitely about him, but it's about so much more. It involves Aristotle and the other Stoics, and
talk about things that you don't control completely. That's the title of a book, even your own book, right? I've discovered that to my chagrin that once I started publishing books, it turns out that both for the cover and the title and subtitles are not really up to me.
Yeah,
I can make suggestions.
Yeah,
but So you're right. The title, even though Socrates and Alcibiades, which are in the subtitle of the book, do play a major role. They kind of set the stage, and that's why the publisher, I guess, or the publicists went for that kind of subtitle.
By the way, I'm publishing a picture book in a couple of years called The Pirate Rabbi. And I really fought for the title Ahoy Vey, The Pirate Rabbi's Tale, you know, playing on the Yiddish Oy Vey and Ahoy Vey. But I didn't win that battle. So I hear
exactly.
You. Okay, so what's I know there's a lot in this book, but what is your main argument that you're making in this Quest for Character book?
So the main argument is that character matters, and matters that much more than we give it credit, especially these days, that the Greco-Romans were right when they were focusing on character. It matters at different levels. Our own character matters because it's essentially the thing that is arguably the most consequential thing in your life, because your character, a character is simply a set of behavioral attitudes and tendencies, right? Mm-hmm. So whether you are going to be generous or stingy, courageous or cowardly and so on and so forth. So basically your character determines how you react to pretty much everything that life is going to throw at you. And mm-hmm. Distinction between what is and is not up to me, right? Life throws at me, it's not really up under my control, but I can work on reacting in the best way possible. So character is important for each one of us, but particularly I think is important for our leaders, for statesmen, for politicians.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an area where we pay even less attention, I think, than we should. to the issue of character. Because, you know, we tend to focus, and I made that mistake myself in the past. When you consider a politician, you should I vote or not vote for this
right.
person, right? Typically, the first thing you ask yourself is which party mm-hmm. do they belong, right? Which right there is not very helpful, actually, for in terms of if we're interested in improving society at large, because partisanship is a bad idea in the
right.
first place.
Okay.
But setting that aside, then the next question that we're going to ask is, well, what positions does this person support,
mm-hmm.
right? So what policies would he or she try to enact, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a good question, but it overestimates what a politician might be able to actually do if elected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can run for political office and say, here's my platform, right? I'm going to try to do this and this and that and the other. But again, trying is up to me. Actually succeeding is not, because, of course, politics is a game of compromise, is a game of having to interact with hundreds of other people
mm-hmm.
in order to achieve something, to arrive at a certain point, which means that at the end of the day, I think the character of the person is more important than the specific policies, because the character is what's going to determine whether that person is, first of all, honest and
right.
reliable and trustworthy, whether he or she can work with other people and actually get some stuff done, as opposed to just throw a tantrum when she doesn't get her things, her way.
So you're saying you're essentially voting first and foremost for the person and who he or she is and afterwards for those other things. You know, I had a similar realization when a recent politician, I'm not going to say who it was, but I didn't approve of the character of that politician. And that actually made me reconsider a little bit. Now, I was pretty young in the 90s. I mean, I was a teenager, but reconsider how I viewed Bill Clinton and some of his actions as a president, right?
Yeah.
At which time I wasn't viewing that through the lens of the character, and realizing how what it meant to disapprove of the character of a leader. That realization that I had more recently allowed me to kind of reframe and rethink about some of my stances in the 90s around the Clinton Lewinsky scandal, I guess you could say.
That's right. I mean, look, I consider myself, broadly speaking, a progressive liberal.
Mm-hmm.
But frankly, these days, I would rather vote for, let's say, a Winston Churchill, who was a conservative,
mm-hmm.
Rather than a Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because I think that in terms of characters, Churchill was trying to do the right thing as he saw it. And in fact, some of his position, the reason I'm mentioning him, it's not out of the blue, it's because I'm reading a biography of him. And, it turns out actually there are a lot of his positions where what we would consider today progressive liberal, even though he was a Tory, he was certainly a conservative, much more progressive liberal than things that I've seen from Clinton or some of the other Democrats in the United States.
I don't know if in the biography you've gotten yet to the part with him in India and World War II and that what that'll do there. But yeah, certainly he was a fascinating figure. So in your book, you talk about obviously the three most important or most famous, we should say, Greek philosophers, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. You also talk about Stoics. And I was surprised to see so much overlap between the Stoics and Aristotle, which I didn't realize. And how are they similar? And just focusing on Aristotle rather than Plato or Socrates, how are the Stoics similar in their views of character to Aristotle? And are there any differences there?
There are some differences, but you're right. The similarities are actually interesting. And these days, I tend to be more interested in similarities, I guess, than differences between philosophies and positions. I like the notion that there is more common ground than people sometimes realize. However, broadly speaking, both Aristotle and the Stoics agree that character is crucial and that it can be improved. Aristotle famously thought that the way to improve character is by practice, essentially, by mindful.
And that's
practice.
That term phronesis, right?
Practical wisdom. That's right.
Okay.
And so Aristotle basically said, look, if you want to improve your character, you have to make the decision, first of all. It starts with a cognitive, mindful decision. And then you just have to practice, meaning because habit is what, eventually makes changes behavioral patterns. And in that sense, Aristotle was very modern, because that's what a modern cognitive behavioral therapist would tell you. Mm-hmm. If you want to change your behavioral patterns, you have to start with the cognitive part, with the decision of doing it, realizing where you want to go. But then you just have to put it into practice in terms of behavioral modification. And the Stoics picked up that ball and run with it. In fact, they developed a number of techniques, practical, specific techniques. Aristotle was much more interested in theory. Mm-hmm. The Stoics were definitely practical, pragmatic. And in fact, modern cognitive behavioral therapy, which started in the 1950s with Aaron Beck and Albert Ellis, both of them were directly influenced by Epictetus, one of the great Stoic philosophers, him. Right? So that's what they have in common. The thing that they have in the major difference, I think, between Stoicism and Aristotelianism is in the relative importance that these two philosophies put on two fundamental concepts. One is virtue, and the other one is so-called externals, that is things like wealth and health and reputation and stuff like that.
So what is this virtue? Because that's another, like character, that's another word that sounds so ancient, actually, but you're saying we need to come back to this, right?
Yeah, I think so. Well, virtue, so before we go back to the Aristotle and the Stoics, virtue is really a positive character, is a set of positive character traits. Mm-hmm. So virtues are things like courage, which is a character trait, temperance, which is a character trait, justice in the sense, not of a general theory of justice, but in the sense of treating other people fairly and with respect, that sort of stuff, right? So virtues are really positive character traits, and conversely, vices are negative character traits, right? So stinginess, cowardness, and so on and so forth, those are negative character traits. So when you think of virtue, think of positive character traits, and that's what we're talking about. Now, Aristotle and the Stoics differed on this in this point. Aristotle, who was an aristocrat, we have to remember, so he had a little bit of a particular point of view when coming into these things. He thought, look, in order to live a eudaimonic life, as the Greeks called it, that is a life worth living. Right? Eudaimonia just means having a good demon that guides you, but basically it means a life worth living. The kind of life that you get to the end of and you look back and say, yeah, that was not wasted. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, by assumption, we all want to live a eudaimonic life. It's hard to imagine somebody says, nope, I really prefer a shitty life. Right. I don't really like it, right? That seems like weird. So Aristotle said, well, in order to do that, you do need virtue. That is, you need, because we are social animals, cooperative, et cetera, et cetera, you do need positive character traits. Otherwise, you're going to have a hard life. You're going to, people are not going to like you, and you're not going to do the right thing, and so on and so forth. However, Aristotle said, on top of that, you need a little bit of wealth. Mm-hmm. You don't need to be uber rich, but a little bit of wealth. You need health. You need a little bit of education, and even a little bit of good looks.
Yeah.
If you don't have those things, you can be virtuous, but your life is going to suck.
Good. That's really good interesting. The good looks part. That's fascinating.
You're right. Exactly. Yeah. And so, of course, Aristotle pointed out that part of this is up to you, the virtue part. But part of it is not. It's a matter of luck, right? Whether you have good looks or not, whether you your reputation and so on, in part it's the result of luck. The Stoics took a very different approach to the same thing. They agreed with Aristotle that by far the most important thing in life is your character.
Right.
And so you should work constantly, every day, on improving. Self-improvement meant shaping a better and better character. However, they said everything else is in fact entirely indifferent. It doesn't matter whether you are healthy or not, whether you're wealthy or not, whether you have a good reputation or not. You are going to be your character is unaffected by that. And since the only thing that matters is your character, you're okay. You're fine.
Yeah.
Now, of course, they did recognize, the Stoics did recognize, that those things have value, that reputation, health, wealth, etc., do have value. They make your life easier, right? But they thought that ultimately, even those things depend at least in part on your character. If you're very wealthy, for instance, but you have a bad character, you're going to use that wealth for bad reasons. You're going to use it to, you know, corrupt the political system or something like that. And that's not good.
The Stoics seem to have a bit of a Buddhist mindset. Yeah. Right.
Yep. That's right. So Stoicism and Buddhism, I often think of Stoicism as the Western equivalent of Buddhism.
Mm.
They kind of evolved in about the same time. Buddhism started maybe 150, 200 years earlier, but not much. You're right. There is a lot of similarities. The ethics is very, very similar.
Yeah.
Metaphysics underlying that ethics is completely different.
And one thing,
there's a really big difference there.
One thing that I think is interesting about Aristotle, when you point out a virtue like courage, is I remember reading in his writing, or perhaps it was in your book, that courage for him is really a moderate virtue, right? So all of his virtues he finds in between a vice, like you said, which is being a scaredy cat, and the other one, which is being completely reckless. So courage is not having that, you know, complete daring, I'm going to do whatever. It's being able to find what that midpoint is so interesting.
Right. Well, for the Stoics, on the other hand, virtues and vices are bipolar. They're polar opposites.
Mm.
There's courage over here, cowardice is over there.
Yeah.
It's not a question of middle ground. So yeah, it's a different way of looking at virtues and vices.
And I love that idea of practicing towards something. It reminds me of a Jewish teaching that if you don't like somebody, you should practice being nice to them, and you should do just nice things for them. And eventually your heart will follow. You will learn to like them once you're doing nice things, and then they're going to be nice back to you. And it's going to set off this whole chain reaction. But this idea that we can set our actions out first and just do better things, and eventually that will mold our character. Is that kind of Aristotle's idea as well?
That is also Aristotle's idea, although Aristotle's notion was inwardly directed. That is, it's about improving your own character.
Mm-hmm.
The Stoics agreed with both perspectives. They said that if you act in a pro-social, cooperative, you know, nice way, that both improves yourselves, that you become a better person in doing so, but it also makes better the human, what they call the human cosmopolis, the big family of humanity. So you do it for both reasons, both because it's better for you and because it's better for the rest of the world.
And in your book, Quest for Character, you go over a few examples where philosophers tried to teach politicians how to be virtuous. I know one of them is with Aristotle and Alexander the Great, and you talk about Marcus Aurelius and Seneca, the Stoic, and which emperor was it again?
Sorry, say it again.
Nero?
Seneca and Nero, yes.
So what's the big lesson that comes out of that? Were they successful? You talked about how we could improve character. How did they do there, and what does that teach us?
So there are two chapters in the book where I go into those examples. And I think the general rule, perhaps not surprisingly, but the general pattern that emerges from those examples is that if somebody tries to teach, typically in the cases that I evaluate, these are philosophers, but if somebody tries to teach a good character to somebody who is not receptive, it's not going to go well. Seneca did not succeed with Nero. Nero was not interested. Plato tried twice with two different leaders of Syracuse, Dionysus the First and Dionysus the Second, and as a result, he almost lost his life twice. In the first case, he was sold into slavery and had to be bought back by his friends, and in the second case, he was put in house arrest for a long time. So those instances don't work because the individuals are not receptive. The target individuals are not receptive.
Mm.
The cases that where the thing does work is where the individual is receptive. So those are Marcus Aurelius, for instance, who was interested in philosophy as a statesman, and he went to teachers, like in this case, one of his most influential teachers was a guy named Junius Rusticus, who was
a
Stoic.
And he was a Roman Stoic, right? Who then goes on to become an emperor.
Yes, to become an emperor. One of the so-called five good emperors of that period. But there are other examples. There is a third case involving Plato. Plato tried and succeeded a third time with a guy named Dion. And that's because Dion was interested. He was receptive to Plato's efforts. To some extent, you can argue that Aristotle succeeded with Alexander the Great for the same reason, because Alexander was actually receptive to Aristotle's teachings. Cato the Younger, who was a Roman senator during the Republic, same idea. He was a Stoic. Cicero also lived during the Roman Republic. He was not a Stoic. He was a skeptic, but nevertheless, and Platonist, and nevertheless, he was open to learning from philosophy and to put philosophies to use in his work as a statesman. So there are these two obvious groups, categories. If you try to teach somebody who is especially already an adult and they're not receptive, you're wasting your time.
So I guess that
in fact, you might be cut.
I guess that goes with the character trait of curiosity as well, that you would want to have a leader who is curious to learn. You have a chapter in your book that says something, I can't remember the exact, put philosophers in charge, I think was the name of your chapter. So do you want a philosopher king? Like, I think that was Plato, right? Who said we should have philosopher
kings? Yeah, it was Plato.
Is that what you're itching for?
Well, I don't go for monarchy, so not exactly a philosopher king, but certainly philosopher statesman. Mm. However, the important thing here is to keep in mind that there are two fairly different meanings of the word philosopher, right? A philosopher, especially nowadays, is an academic such as myself who spends time in a university teaching, you know, students and so on and so forth. That is not the person you want in charge of things. Those are people that belong to the ivory tower. That's where they are, and then that's where they should stay. However, for the Greco-Romans, philosopher just meant broadly somebody who tries to live their lives in a philosophical, mindful manner, right? So a philosopher would be anybody that espouses a philosophy of life or even a religion. So a Buddhist would be a philosopher, for instance. Mm-hmm. Right? Any Buddhist practitioner, not just Buddha, but any Buddhist practitioner, any Stoic, any Epicurean, and so on and so forth, they would all be philosophers if they actually try to live their lives according to certain principles and precepts. And so, yeah, basically, so in other words, what that means is that what you want are leaders who actually try mindfully to be better people in what they do on a day-to-day basis, mm-hmm. right? As opposed to just taking advantage of other people, self-aggrandizing, search for glory and money and so on and so forth. People that really try mindfully to live a better life and a life that is good for the community at large and not just for themselves. If that's what we mean by philosopher, then yes, I would argue that philosophers ought to be in charge.
It's so interesting, Massimo, because obviously as a teacher, one of the questions that gets brought up is to what extent are we teaching content and what extent are we teaching skills? But you rarely hear the, at least at the high school level, I think you hear more that the elementary school teacher, to what extent are we teaching character, right? Are we teaching our students? How often are we saying to them, be a good person, right? And then, of course, comes the question, well, what is a good person? And that's where you need philosophy to help us out. And we may have in this country huge political disagreements, but hopefully I think that there ought not to be a huge amount of disagreement on those four virtues that you talked about, right? Which are, what are those four virtues again? We could arrive at some kind of consensus that we like those virtues.
I would think so. I mean, the four virtues are practical wisdom, which is knowledge of what is really good and what is not good.
Mm-hmm.
Courage, justice, and temperance. Right?
Yeah.
So courage is the notion that you're going to try to do the right thing, even though it may cost you personally. Justice, as I said before, it means just treating other people fairly and with respect. And temperance is the notion that you're going to do things in right measure, neither too much nor too little.
Right.
Yeah, you would think that we could easily agree, particularly because those four virtues are actually part of the seven Christian virtues.
Mm-hmm.
The Christian virtues, as defined by Thomas Aquinas, are those four, which he took from the Stoics directly, And then the additional three of hope, charity, and faith. Right. So
faith,
you
faith
would think,
might be harder,
should,
but
should be a no-brainer.
Yeah,
Faith may
on
be harder.
How you
Right.
define faith. Well, it's really interesting too, because I know some of the medieval Jewish philosophers as well, Maimonides, Rambam, they draw on Aristotle too. And sometimes I read this and they say, wow, it's amazing that they have such similar ideas. And then I forget, of course, I have to remind myself that Maimonides was influenced by Aristotle and bringing that to some degree into Judaism. But to close off, so you had this midlife crisis, and rather than getting a Ferrari, you got Aristotle and the Stoics. And a lot of people kind of get their how should we say it, their guide to a good life from religion. You found it in ancient philosophies. Have you found that your character and life have improved at all from studying these practical philosophies?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, first of all, let me clarify one thing. I actually think of religions as a kind of philosophy of life.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't see a sharp distinction there. Obviously, the metaphysics is different, right? If you're a Christian, which I was, I grew up Catholic. Obviously, you accept a different kind of metaphysics, let's say, in comparison to a Stoic. But other than that, both religions and philosophies of life have a metaphysics, that is an account of how the world works.
Right.
They have an ethics, that is an account of how we should behave in the world. And they have usually a set of practices, things like meditations, prayer, reading texts, and so on and so forth. So I don't really think that there is a huge distinction there to be made between religions and philosophies of life. Has it worked? Yes, I think so. I mean, especially if you ask my friends and my wife, they will tell you that I'm a, you know, significantly, or though not perhaps enough yet, but a significantly better person. I get upset much less, for instance.
Yeah.
I have developed a certain sense of equanimity about what happens to me and to my loved ones. I am more focused about my own behavior and things that are important or not important, things that I need to pursue or not pursue, and so on and so forth. So it has made an effect, but it's not just the study of it.
Right.
It's the study coupled with the practice.
Right.
Because, you know, as Epictetus, the Stoic, the second century Stoic, says to his own students, you know, you can understand all the theory and then do nothing. And in which case you're not really a philosopher, you're not really practicing philosophy. You're just playing games. You're just being a literary critic, basically.
Well, that's inspiring to hear. And I agree with you. I think that's why the kind of debate over whether something like Buddhism or Confucianism are religions or philosophies, in a sense, it doesn't matter that much. And every religion certainly has a huge amount of philosophy in it. So do you have a couple of books that you could recommend besides your own, obviously, excellent books on these topics about either Stoicism or Greek philosophy, or just books that will help people think about living a good life?
Yes, there are plenty of options actually out there, as it turns out. But two of my favorites are John Sellers' The Art of Living, which is, as the title implies, it's mostly about Stoicism, really. But it is about the art of living, or a philosophy of life as understood by the Hellenistic philosophers. And I still think that the Hellenists are one of the best models for how to do that. They're not the only models, as I said, right? Buddhists are certainly an alternative model. Some religions are a very good model as well. But the Hellenists really got a lot of things right. So John Sellers' The Art of Living is a good one. It's written with a little bit of technical jargon, but you get over that very quickly. And it has a lot of practical, interesting aspects to it. Another one, a second book, is not a book of philosophy per se. In fact, it's by a psychologist, Christian Miller. The title of the book is The Character Gap. And it really looks at the complement in a complementary fashion. Instead of looking at a philosophy of character and character improvement, it looks at the science and the empirical evidence. And so the title, The Character Gaps, comes from this notion that we would like to be a certain kind of person, but we're not there yet.
Yeah.
And so the question is, how do you bridge that gap, right?
Yeah.
And Christian brings up all of the empirical evidence that is available today on what character is, how it is shaped, and how we can improve it. And since I am a philosopher, yes, but I'm also a scientist, I kind of like to see the two things together. I think that science without philosophy, it's a little bit blind. It does not have a kind of a coherence that I think should have. But at the same time, philosophy without science is just a lot of talk that is not directed to actual improvement, actually empirical based, evidence based improvement. So I would say that those two books are some of the best in terms of complementing each other if your goal is to really start becoming a better person beginning today.
Fantastic. Well, they sound incredible. And again, I love your books as well. So Field Guide to a Happy Life, How to Be a Stoic. There are so many great ones. And you have this incredible website with resources about philosophy and stoicism too. So thank you for all of that. Well, thanks so much, Massimo. I really appreciate it.
It's been a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Thank you to my guest and also to Colin McGrath for the beautiful background music. You can check out all of Colin's music, including his amazing album Window Seat on Spotify. You can also take a look at my books, upcoming picture books, materials for teachers, and writings on authentic assessment and other topics in social studies like role plays and mock trials at davidsharon.com. Thanks for joining me today. Hope you come on back.